Hello and a very warm welcome to Section D, Monocle 24's dedicated design show. I'm your host, Josh Bennett. So, what's in a logo? On today's show, we mull over the benchmarks of branding and the benefits of having a likable one.
People started buying the brands for what they represented rather than what they actually were. You bought a Chanel bag not because it was a really great made product, but because it had a double C on the front.
We speak to partner at design firm Pentagram to find out a few rules of thumb for identity design and talk over the changing importance of branding in the fashion industry. We also stop in Toronto to find out a few stories behind the city's seal and examine the success of Canadian logo design. We also hear a story of bold branding and how the Italian typewriter firm Olivetti's logo is still making an impression. All that to come right here on Section D on Monocle 24. To kick off our logo-themed special, we head to a country that has long known the importance of a strong visual identity. We're talking, of course, about Canada. A sharp and memorable logo mark isn't just crucial to a company's successful branding. They can be an asset to nations, too. Monocle's Toronto correspondent Chris Frey took up the mantle of decoding the successes and failures of Brand Canada and its visual identity. He also asks whether, under new Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, a brand refresh might be in the offing.
Every year at Davos, there's a country that stands out, attracting attention and admiration. This year, it was not so much a nation, but a person. Justin Trudeau, the new 44-year-old Prime Minister of Canada, was the star of the World Economic Forum.
He's so handsome!
He's so handsome! He's been mobbed by movie stars and politicians at Davos, and mobbed by shrieking girls in Manila, awaiting him outside on the street. Ever since he became Prime Minister last fall, Justin Trudeau has given Canada's brand a healthy boost, sharply shifting how the country is seen at home and abroad. His good looks, charisma, and pedigree have certainly helped, but so has his politics of inclusivity, singling out Canada at a time when xenophobic populist movements are gaining sway in parts of Europe and the United States. With so much goodwill in the air, it's worth asking, how does this new brand Canada distill itself into appealing national symbols? And what can a great logo or mark do for a country in the first place? Hilary Ashworth is the executive director of the Association of Registered Graphic Designers of Canada.
I think that a visual image can really express a lot of the values, both of the citizens and for those outside of the country to recognize and understand the image that those citizens want to portray. And it can really help to identify the country in all of its communications and all of the ways that it's hoping to be visible in the world.
Looking back at some of the visual identities that have been, or symbols that have been created for Canada over the last 50 years, how good a job have we done at creating those symbols?
Well, I mean, I think there's no question that 1967 is seen as a high watermark, a high water point for Canada and its identity from a design perspective, both visually and architecturally, through across all of the disciplines.
It's in 1967 that Canada celebrated its centennial, and Montreal played host to the World's Fair, a landmark year that came complete with a bouncy new jingle. The birthday was seized upon for all its nation-building potential. Only 2 years before, Canada got its maple leaf flag, a controversial move at the time that almost lost the Prime Minister re-election. Meanwhile, the government invested heavily in creating new arts venues and cultural institutions. What also began to emerge was the beginning of a distinctively Canadian modern aesthetic, evident in the design of commemorative materials and some of the now iconic buildings that were commissioned, such as Moishe Safdie's visionary residential complex called Habitat. What impresses today is how much design was made a centerpiece of the celebrations.
That had a lot to do with the development of the National Design Council, which was created to really inform a national design policy. And there were a lot of designers that were involved and came together and were able to craft an identity that was really meaningful. And certainly the work of Stuart Ashe is known. The identity he did for the Centennial was a great example of how design can really be memorable and recognizable for, you know, more than 50 years.
The work that Ashworth is referring to is the official Centennial logo mark created by Stuart Ashe, a stylized geometrical maple leaf composed of differently colored triangles representing the Canadian regions. A much-loved logo that still looks fresh and contemporary today.
I was 6 years of age when that mark came onto the scene.
Lionel Gowdery is the principal of Context Creative in Toronto.
But that mark imprinted itself on my imagination, and I remember figuring out those patterns and that sense of color and what the meaning was. And I remember drawing that mark myself, and I think that many of us at that age did that. It really inspired me to become a graphic designer. It's probably the earliest mark that I can still distinctly remember being fascinated with.
Je proclame l'ouverture des Jeux Olympiques de 1976.
After the Queen honors Montreal by pronouncing the opening address in French, Olympic symbolism continues with...
Thanks in part to the National Design Council, that emphasis on strong design in the country's self-presentation carried through to the symbols and poster art created for the 1976 Olympics in Montreal. By the mid-80s, however, the Design Council was disbanded, the victim of budget cuts and a change in government. The country's marks and brand identity have mostly suffered for it, especially under Trudeau's predecessor, Stephen Harper.
Our understanding from the past government, we did quite a bit of lobby work on this, is a general belief that cheaper is better. And really short-term cheaper. So hiring designers based on low price compliancy so that the lowest bid is always selected. We've suffered from a situation where design is selected based on price alone and not on expertise, not on vision, not on an ability to manage the process, which a really good designer is able to do.
The most notorious example of this mindset was when the Harper government initially gave the job of creating a logo for Canada's 150th birthday, coming in 2017, to in-house bureaucrats with no professional design experience. The results were as awful and embarrassing as you'd expect.
That really was the most shocking. It was jaw-dropping. Needless to say, they were busy, they were predictable, they were plagued with problems that you wouldn't be able to reproduce these appropriately. It was pretty hard to imagine any type of merchandising getting in behind those marks. They were just generic, bad, amateur attempts.
Prominent graphic designers from across the country began posting their own Canada 150 logos in response, many even offering to do the work pro bono. But even then, the government refused professional help, instead launching a logo design competition open only to students. But while many creatives lament the lost opportunity to do something special for the sesquicentennial, there's the expectation that with Canada's stock rising under Justin Trudeau, the designer's voice will be welcome again in Ottawa.
Trudeau has certainly indicated his interest in innovation and new ideas, and there is a real opportunity to demonstrate that design is a huge part of how we express that and how we present that. And there are lots of great other examples of countries like Denmark, like the UK, where design has become part of their identity and if they've really used it for commercial success. And I think there's probably more that needs to be done to educate young designers on this really strong design history that we have.
For Monocle, in Toronto, I'm Chris Frey.
the fashion industry has fallen in and out of love with logos. Once regarded as a mark of finesse and favour, a visible emblem, depending on how and where it's worn, can seem anything from tacky to tasteful. So, who was the first fashion designer to emblazon his or her apparel with a distinctive mark? And how has the deployment of logos changed and developed over time? Well, fashion journalist Dana Thomas, the author of Deluxe, How Luxury Lost Its Luster, visited Midori House to speak with Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco to explain more.
Look at the beginning. I mean, who were the first fashion designers that started to use logo in a prominent way?
I think the first was actually Chanel. Coco Chanel started putting the Chanel logo inside handbags, not on the outside. And then after her death, I think, maybe it was in the 60s or the early 70s, somewhere in there, the Chanel company decided to move the logo to the outside of the bag. But in the old days, you put your own initials on the outside and you had the logo on the inside.
What do you think was the, you know, especially in the beginning, the main purpose of the logo? Do you think was something aspirational, perhaps?
No, it was actually a way of marking a company's trademark so you could know that it was the real thing. It was an anti-counterfeiting measure. And that's the irony of it, is that today the counterfeiters use the logos in order to sell, make and sell their products. And Louis Vuitton started with its trademark sort of grid with the Japanese symbols as a anti-counterfeiting device, and that became their logo.
Let's talk a little bit about logo trends over time, you know. I mean, for example, when I think about the 80s, I think that's when logos reached their peak. Would you agree with me?
I think so, though. There was a time in the late 90s where it came pretty close to that peak again. The logo mania and, as a result, also the counterfeiting in the late 90s was really a little scary. And people were having counterfeiting parties, counterfeiting items sold at their homes, a bit like Tupperware. But in the 80s, yeah, it was pretty heavy. And it wasn't simply luxury brands. It was everything. It was Nike swooshes, and it was Rolex watches, and it was, you know, across the board logos.
And now, again, I think things are changing, especially, I would say, perhaps in Europe, that actually logos are not that cool anymore. So you have to be kind of more understated. So I presume there's a difference between markets as well and how people use logos. I'm talking about today. What do you think?
Well, there was definitely a crash of logo mania in 2008 after the economic crash, because it just became very uncool to show your wealth, because so many people lost their wealth. And I'm not talking about the middle class. I'm talking about the super rich, you know, the people who lost their wealth in the stock market, the people who lost their wealth because of Madoff. And so one did not show their wealth through mounting logos saying, I can afford this and therefore I'm wearing it. And it's been slow to return, in part because there's still a serious swath of the population that's suffering from the economic crisis. And it's just not good to rub it into people's faces. So it is far more discreet. And it's become more about craftsmanship as opposed to the stamp of the logo. It seems like there was a shift in the luxury and fashion industry where people started buying the brands for what they represented rather than what they actually were. That you bought a Chanel bag not because it was a really great Chanel, you know, great made product, but because it had the double C on the front, or the quilting, which is a signature like a logo, or the same thing with a Louis Vuitton suitcase. You were buying the Rolly suitcase not because it was a particularly great Rolly suitcase, but because it had that logo, so it showed that you had flair and savoir-faire and money. But today that's less the case because so many people are suffering, and because of the disparity of wealth, the rich don't want to show off too much, and the middle class doesn't have the money to show off anymore.
But some brands, I've been noticing that, especially now, they might use logos sometimes in an ironic way as well. For example, if you think about new brands, I believe there's this brand Vetements, you know, that, you know, apparently they're doing quite well. They have this DHL kind of T-shirts, which are becoming quite cool at the moment.
Yeah, so Jeremy Scott did his entire collection on McDonald's, which I just thought was hysterical. I love Jeremy Scott, and I love that he's sending up people. And it's a really nice marriage, that designer with that brand, because, of course, that's what Moschino was doing originally in the 1980s before he died of AIDS, sadly, and we lost that sense of irony in fashion.
That was fashion journalist Dana Thomas speaking to Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco about the long history of logos in fashion. We are surrounded by brands, and at their best, the identities and images created around them can stick in our memory and colour our perceptions of the products we consume. But who's behind some of the best ones, and how do they come up with them? The London office of design agency Pentagram are the creators of some of the most exciting examples of brand building, including the successfully old-school livery and identity of the newly launched Great Western Railway. I sat down with partner John Rushworth to find out a few rules of thumb for identity design and why he never accepts a brief from a client when designing one.
What more or less happens today in most situations for certainly serious identity projects is that you embark on a review of a client's needs, their business, I suppose, their, you know, why they've come to you to think about an identity. Because often, most of the time, you are looking at existing companies rather than startups. I mean, yes, we do startups as well, but we're talking about existing companies. So what is making them change? And there are a number of things that you have to, I think, rationally solve first. I mean, identities or logos, if you like. Logos, we could get into a very long subject here, but logos obviously comes from the word logotype. A logotype is a word mark. The other thing that designers often design, which are called logos, are symbols, actually. And symbols come in two forms. They're either pictorial, like the apple symbol or the shell symbol, or they're abstract, like, I don't know, NatWest or something. Or you get a monogram. You know, the monocle mark is a monogram, I would say. There actually only are those four options. You know, it's not very many. And you have to think about those things because the condition of any project, one of those four solutions, in a sense, is right for different types of companies.
And your work at Pentagram kind of precedes you. You've done so many big branding projects in the London office and the New York office. Pentagram's kind of way of looking at the world is quite ubiquitous. But we have three specific examples of the work that you've undertaken, which I was hoping to talk to you about. The first one, and perhaps the most striking, the one that I feel has been picked up the most, is the rebrand of Great Western Railway. Can you tell us a little bit about how you approached this project?
In this case, as I've described, the client came to us. It was at the time they were looking to bid for the franchise. And so they were putting together, you know, their thoughts on how best to approach that, both from a point of view of First Group, who were, in a sense, the corporate company behind the Great Western Railway.
That's right. They were called First Great Western, and they've actually gone back to the old Victorian name, isn't it?
Exactly, yes. It comes, yes, exactly, Victorian or early Victorian, actually. So this was a new strategy for them. But also, I think it was a recognition of the reality of what existed on the Great Western Railway, and that the culture, no matter who'd been in, let's say, in charge of the franchise and the railway line, everything from British Rail onwards, the pride of the people who worked for that line or that network somehow still existed. Their pride still was there deep down. You just had to, you know, in a sense, remind them or ask them about why they worked on the railway and, you know, what drove them every day to try and do a decent job. And it was something that I think our client felt very strongly about. They were very passionate about the railway, and therefore they wanted to take this franchise and use it as an example, to show an example to the rest of, let's say, the railway networks of Britain, that the railways could be handled in a new way.
And how does an insignia enable a company to do that? And how do you translate the bravado of saying that they're going to take pride in their, you know, railway service in the future into a tangible thing which you can hold in your hand, which you can see on the livery of a train, into a colour, into a sign?
In a sense, what we said to ourselves was, look, if the original GWR monogram from the 1930s, if that was our starting point, and let's say this is an organisation that had been in the same hands for the last 80 years since that moment, where would this mark have ended up? And you could well have imagined through evolution that this is more or less the journey that it would have ended up at. So it's historic. If you put it on a high-speed train that's 40 years old anyway, it sort of feels like it has history in it. But if you put it on a modern new train that's about to arrive in the next couple of years from Japan, it feels contemporary.
And it's had a lot of extremely positive coverage in the design press, and I'd encourage any of our listeners that haven't seen it to go and look. The GWR rebrand by London's Pentagram We're going to move on. I'm going to change tack a little bit to a company which you flagged called Index Ventures, which you've also done the logo for. This strikes me as interesting because I suppose a venture capital firm, it's quite hard to channel the idea of personality of, you know, people being comfortable with it, people being at ease with it and finding it alluring. How did you approach Index Ventures and coming up with a logo that could sit on letterheads, that could sit in offices, that could be utterly approachable?
Be digital, actually. I mean, it's obviously their world is a digital world. And so it's very much a very different type of culture that we're going to talk about here, because Index are one of the top 5-10 venture firms in the world. You know, they're very influential. They started in Geneva in the 90s, came to London, have a very successful office in London, and then went to San Francisco in the early 2000s. But they remain a very European culture, very European firm, amongst mainly an American, their American counterparts. And as such, they have a very different, let's say, approach to their entrepreneurs. In a nutshell, I suppose, I would say, you know, that they are a much more matriarchal firm, you know, in terms of the way in which they support their investments, but not take over.
So with their culture captured, I mean, again, it's the thing I find fascinating is how you turn that into an image, how you turn that into a set of visual rules to help people identify with it. What was the what gave you a first hand?
The hand is an interesting way of thinking about it. But the first thing you've got to think about is that this is a financial services business, first and foremost. What most of them have, most of their competitors, most other financial services businesses in other areas of finance have logotypes. They have word marks, and usually long word marks. You know, Index Ventures was the word mark before we looked at what they were like. And there was a mismatch between, let's say, how you did business with them and their offices and their, in a sense, very sophisticated approach to what they did, and their wordmark and their website and so on. So in looking at this nurturing idea of a matriarchal thought, we also thought that they should have a what I would call a more consumer-facing brand, because they invest in things like Moleskine as well as tech firms, Blue Bottle Cafe and so on. And so their aspiration, I think, was much more, in a sense, as a consumer-facing brand. And so thinking of those things plus the word index, we connected to the hand. And the hand as a metaphor, obviously, is a very useful idea for supporting and creating that kind of culture that I described.
And I wonder how much opposition you faced from traditionalists or people that thought that the company always needed to have the company's name in the logo.
None at all within Index, because, as I say, they're a very sophisticated group of people. They wanted, I think, something. They couldn't articulate what they wanted, but they wanted something which was distinctive and special and beyond what the other firms in their sector, how the other firms in their sector behaved. So they welcomed it with open arms, actually. In fact, I think it's been very positive for them, and they see it as a huge asset.
John Rushworth there, a partner at Pentagram's offices in London, speaking to me a little earlier at Midori House. Olivetti, the Italian company that's famous for its typewriters, also has one of the late 20th century's most recognisable logos. The firm was an early adopter of meticulous design in both its products and showrooms, as well as all its printed material and visual identity. This design heritage is being celebrated in an exhibition at London's Institute of Contemporary Arts named Olivetti, Beyond Form and Function. Monocle's irrepressible Henry Rhys Sheridan paid a visit to the ICA to get the lowdown from curator Juliette Desorgue.
Most of the material in the exhibition came from the Olivetti archive in Ivrea, which is the original site of Olivetti, from 1908 until the 70s. The rest of the ephemera was also sourced locally in London, some from the Architecture Association library, but also we have some of the machines, original Olivetti typewriters and a Divisima calculator, which were all sourced locally in London by private collectors.
Now, this is a show themed around logos, and Olivetti has one of the most famous corporate logos that's been used extensively on its products and its marketing. Do you want to give me a quick potted history of the Olivetti logo, and maybe we can have a look at some of the most prominent uses of it around here?
Giovanni Pinturi, who was, you know, one of the most iconic Italian graphic designers from the kind of 30s and post-war era, and he worked for Olivetti from the sort of 30s onwards until the 60s. And so he, the sort of very iconic Olivetti logo he designed in 1947, which is the first poster we see in the exhibition for his very famous numbers poster, which shows the name Olivetti written very simply in lowercase. And then this particular format was then revisited at a later date in 1960 by Pinturi as well, who just made it slightly bolder. And then in 1970, Walter Bulmer, who's a Swiss graphic designer who also worked with Olivetti quite a lot. But one logo that was also very iconic was the one designed in the 50s by Marcello Nizzoli, who's also known for designing a lot of the key typewriters like the Littera 22 and 32. And that one was this sort of abstract kind of swirling logo, which is, again, meant to represent a typewriter. So that particular logo, you find it on a lot of the material, particularly the advertisements, alongside, sometimes on its own, and sometimes alongside the actual name of the company, Olivetti.
And the care and attention that they exhibited in that logo design and the redesigns is typical of the company's approach towards design in general, which was central to the brand. Do you want to give me some examples of the way the brand was innovative when it came to not only incorporating design into their products, but also commissioning original design as well?
So the company very much from Camillo Olivetti, who was the founder, who founded the company in 1908, very much early on saw the need to incorporate design, had just as important a role as the kind of commercial aspects of the company. And Adriano Olivetti, his son, who came in on board quite early on, but very much kind of spearheaded a lot of quite radical and pioneering approach to business in a way from the kind of post-war era onwards. And he brought in a lot of these very important and very influential graphic designers. So first on a freelance basis, and then in the 30s, the family Olivetti created an actual advertising department within the company structure because, you know, they believed in the importance of design within their business model. And this is where someone like Giovanni Pinturi was brought on and who created some of the most iconic Olivetti posters and advertisements using these very bold primary colours, very sort of simplified lines, and simplicity and clarity was very, very key to Olivetti's advertisement. Sometimes the objects themselves or the products weren't even shown on the posters. For instance, the Divisima poster that we have in the exhibition, which was for a calculator, and you don't even see the object itself, which, you know, for an advertisement from 1953 is quite a radical approach.
That was Juliette Desorgues, curator of the exhibition Olivetti Beyond Form and Function, which runs at London's Institute of Contemporary Arts until July the 17th. And sadly, that's all we have time for on this week's show. My very special thanks to our sound engineer, Wei Dong Lin, our ever-patient editor, Alex Funnell, and the show's producer, the absent Henry Reese Sheridan. And our researchers this week were Faith Barker and Hannah Ritchie. If you have any comments or queries, feel free to drop Henry a note at hrs@monocle.com. And remember that we're back at the same time next week. In the meantime, you can always listen again or dip into our back catalogue at monocle.com, SoundCloud or iTunes. And why not leave us a review on the latter? You've been listening to Section D. I'm Josh Fennett. And until next time, thanks for listening and goodbye.